that its aftershocks are still filling up the universe with a uniform haze of radiation. In 1946, Gamow assumed that the Big Bang began with a super-hot core of neutrons. This was a reasonable assumption, since very little was known about subatomic particles other than the electron, proton, and neutron. If he could estimate the temperature of this ball of neutrons, he realized he could calculate the amount and nature of radiation that it emitted. 2 years later, Gamow showed that radiation given off by this super-hot core would act like black-body radiation. This is a very specific type of radiation given off by a hot object. It absorbs all light hitting it, emitting radiation back in a characteristic way. For example, the sun, molten lava, hot coals in a fire, and hot ceramics in an oven all glow yellow-red and emit black-body radiation. Black-body radiation was first discovered by the famed maker of porcelain, Thomas Wedgwood, in 1792. He noticed that when raw materials were baked in his ovens, they changed in color from red to yellow to white as he raised the temperature. This is important because once one knows the color of a hot object, one also knows roughly its temperature, and vice versa. The precise formula relating the temperature of a hot object and the radiation it emits was first obtained by Max Planck in 1900, which led to the birth of the quantum theory. This is, in fact, one way in which scientists determine the temperature of the sun. The sun radiates mainly yellow light, which in turn corresponds to a black body temperature of roughly 6,000 K. Thus, we know the temperature of the sun's outer atmosphere. Similarly, the red giant star Betelgeuse has a surface temperature of 3,000 K, the black body temperature corresponding to the color red, which is also emitted by a red-hot piece of coal. Gamow's 1948 paper was the first time anyone had suggested that the radiation of the Big Bang might have a specific characteristic, black body radiation. The most important characteristic of black body radiation is its temperature. Next, Gamow had to compute the current temperature of black body radiation. Gamow's PhD student Ralph Alpher and another student, Robert Herman, tried to complete Gamow's calculation by computing its temperature. Gamow wrote, "Extrapolating from the early days of the universe to the present time, we find that during the eons which had passed, the universe must have cooled to about 5 degrees above the absolute temperature." In 1948, Alpher and Herman published a paper giving detailed arguments why the temperature of the afterglow of the Big Bang today should be 5 degrees above absolute zero. Their estimate was remarkably close to what we now know is the correct temperature of 2.7 degrees above zero. This radiation, which they identified as being in the microwave range, should still be circulating around the universe today, they postulated, filling up the cosmos with a uniform afterglow. The reasoning is as follows. For years after the Big Bang, the temperature of the universe was so hot that any time an atom formed, it would be ripped apart. Hence, there were many free electrons that could scatter light. Thus, the universe was opaque, not transparent. Any light beam moving in this super-hot universe would be absorbed after traveling a short distance, so the universe looked cloudy. After 380,000 years, however, the temperature dropped to 3,000 degrees. Below that temperature, atoms were no longer ripped apart by collisions. As a result, stable atoms could form, and light beams could now travel for light years without being absorbed. Thus, for the first time, empty space became transparent. This radiation, which was no longer instantly absorbed as soon as it was created, is circulating around the universe today. When Alpher and Herman showed Gamow their final calculation of the temperature of the universe, Gamow was disappointed. The temperature was so cold that it would be extremely difficult to measure. It took Gamow a year to finally agree that the details of their calculation were correct. but he despaired of ever being able to measure such a faint radiation field. Instruments available in the 1940s were hopelessly inadequate to measure this faint echo. In a later calculation, using an incorrect assumption, Gamow pushed the temperature of the radiation up to 50 degrees. They gave a series of talks to publicize their work, but unfortunately their prophetic result was ignored. Alfer has said, "We expended a hell of a lot of energy giving talks about the work. Nobody bit. Nobody said it could be measured. And so, over the period 1948 to 1955, we sort of gave up." Undaunted, Gamow, via his books and lectures, became the leading personality pushing the Big Bang theory. But he met his match in a fierce adversary very much his equal. While Gamow could charm his audience with his impish jokes and witticisms, Fred Hoyle could overpower audiences with his sheer brilliance and aggressive audacity. Fred Hoyle, Contrarian. The microwave background radiation gives us the second proof of the Big Bang, but the man least likely to provide the third great proof of the Big Bang via nucleosynthesis was Fred Hoyle, a man who, ironically, spent almost his entire professional life trying to disprove the Big Bang theory. Hoyle was the personification of an academic misfit, a brilliant contrarian who dared to defy conventional wisdom with his sometimes pugnacious style. While Hubble was the ultimate patrician, emulating the mannerisms of an Oxford don, and Gamow was the entertaining jester and polymath who could dazzle audiences with his quips, limericks, and pranks, Hoyle's style resembled that of a rough-hewn bulldog. He seemed strangely out of place in the ancient halls of Cambridge University, the old haunt of Isaac Newton. Hoyle was born in 1915 in northern England, the son of a textile merchant in an area dominated by the wool industry. As a child, he was excited by science. Radio was just coming to the village, and, he recalled, 20 to 30 people eagerly wired up their homes with radio receivers. But the turning point in his life came when his parents gave him a telescope for a present. Hoyle's combative style started when he was a child. He had mastered the multiplication tables at age 3, and then his teacher asked him to learn Roman numerals. How could anybody be so daft as to write V-I-I-I for 8, he recalled scornfully. But when he was told that the law required him to attend school, he wrote, "I concluded that, unhappily, I'd been born into a world dominated by a rampaging monster called law that was both all-powerful and all-stupid." His disdain for authority was also cemented by a run-in with another teacher, who told the class that a particular flower had 5 petals. Proving her wrong, he brought the flower with 6 petals into class. For that impudent act of insubordination, she whacked him hard in his left ear. Hoyle later became deaf in that ear. Steady-state theory. In the 1940s, Hoyle was not enamored of the Big Bang theory. One defect in the theory was that Hubble, because of errors in measuring light from distant galaxies, had miscalculated the age of the universe to be 1.8 billion years. Geologists claimed that Earth and the solar system were probably many billions of years old. How could the universe be younger than its planets? With colleagues Thomas Gold and Hermann Bondi, Hoyle set out to construct a rival to the theory. Legend has it that their theory, the steady-state theory, was inspired by a 1945 ghost movie called Dead of Night, starring Michael Redgrave. The movie consists of a series of ghost stories, but in the final scene there is a memorable twist. The movie ends just as it began. Thus, the movie is circular, with no beginning or end. This allegedly inspired the three to propose a theory of the universe that also had no beginning or end. Gold later clarified this story. He recalled, I think we saw that movie several months before, and after I proposed the steady state, I said to them, isn't that a bit like Dead of Night? In this model, portions of the universe were in fact expanding, but new matter was constantly being created out of nothing, so that the density of the universe remained the same. Although he could give no details of how matter mysteriously emerged out of nowhere, the theory immediately attracted a band of loyalists who battled the Big Bang theorists. To Hoyle, it seemed illogical that a fiery cataclysm could appear out of nowhere to send the galaxies hurtling in all directions. He preferred the smooth creation of mass out of nothing. In other words, the universe was timeless. It had no end nor a beginning. It just was. The steady-state Big Bang controversy was similar to the controversy affecting geology and other sciences. In geology, there was the enduring debate between uniformitarianism, the belief that Earth has been shaped by gradual changes in the past, and catastrophism, which postulated that change took place via violent events. Although uniformitarianism still explains much of the geologic and ecological features of Earth, no one can now deny the impact of comets and asteroids, which have generated mass extinctions or the breakup and movements of the continents via tectonic drift. BBC Lectures. Hoyle never shied away from a good fight. In 1949, both Hoyle and Gamow were invited by the British Broadcasting Corporation to debate the origin of the universe. During the broadcast, Hoyle made history when he took a swipe at the rival theory. He said fatefully, "These theories were based on the hypothesis that all the matter in the universe was created in one Big Bang at a particular time in the remote past." The name stuck. The rival theory was now officially christened the Big Bang by its greatest enemy. He later claimed that he did not mean it to be derogatory. He confessed, "There is no way in which I coined the phrase to be derogatory. I coined it to be striking." Over the years, proponents of the Big Bang have tried heroically to change the name. They are dissatisfied with the common, almost vulgar connotation of the name and the fact that it was coined by its greatest adversary. Purists are especially irked that it was also factually incorrect. First, the Big Bang was not big, since it originated from a tiny singularity of some sort, much smaller than an atom. And second, there was no bang, since there is no air in outer space. In August 1993, Sky and Telescope magazine sponsored a contest to rename the Big Bang theory. The contest garnered 13,000 entries, but the judges could not find any that was better than the original. What sealed Hoyle's fame to a whole generation was his celebrated BBC radio series on science. In the 1950s, the BBC planned to air lectures on science every Saturday evening. However, when the original guest cancelled, the producers were pressed to find a substitute. They contacted Hoyle, who agreed to come on. Then they checked his file, where there was a note that said, "Do not use this man." Fortuitously, they ignored this dire warning from a previous producer, and he gave 5 spellbinding lectures to the world. These classic BBC broadcasts mesmerized the nation and in part inspired the next generation of astronomers. Astronomer Wallace Sargent recalls the impact that these broadcasts had on him. "When I was 15, I heard Fred Hoyle give lectures on the BBC called The Nature of the Universe. The idea that you knew what the temperature and density were at the center of the sun came as a hell of a shock. At the age of 15, that sort of thing seemed beyond knowledge. It was not just the amazing numbers, but the fact that you could know them at all." Nucleosynthesis in the stars. Hoyle, who disdained idle armchair speculation, set out to test his steady-state theory. He relished the idea that the elements of the universe were cooked not in the Big Bang, as Gamow believed, but in the center of stars. If the 100 or so chemical elements were all created by the intense heat of the stars, then there would be no need for a Big Bang at all. In a series of seminal papers published in the 1940s and 1950s, Hoyle and his colleagues laid out in vivid detail how the nuclear reactions inside the core of a star, not the Big Bang, could add more and more protons and neutrons to the nuclei of hydrogen and helium, until they could create all the heavier elements, at least up to iron. They solved the mystery of how to create elements beyond mass number 5, which had stumped Gamow. In a stroke of genius, Hoyle realized that if there were a previously unnoticed, unstable form of carbon created out of 3 helium nuclei, it might last just long enough to act as a bridge, allowing for the creation of higher elements. In the core of stars, this new, unstable form of carbon might last just long enough so that, by successively adding more neutrons and protons, one could create elements beyond mass number 5 and 8. When this unstable form of carbon was actually found, it brilliantly demonstrated that nucleosynthesis could take place in stars, rather than the Big Bang. Hoyle even created a large computer program that could determine, almost from first principles, the relative abundances of elements we see in nature. But even the intense heat of the stars is not sufficient to cook elements beyond iron, such as copper, nickel, zinc, and uranium. It is extremely difficult to extract energy by fusing elements beyond iron for a variety of reasons, including the repulsion of the protons in the nucleus and the lack of binding energy. For those heavy elements, one needs an even larger oven, the explosion of massive stars, or supernovae. Since trillions of degrees can be attained in the final death throes of a supergiant star when it violently collapses, there is enough energy there to cook the elements beyond iron. This means that most of the elements beyond iron were, in fact, blasted out of the atmospheres of exploding stars, or supernovae. In 1957, Hoyle, as well as Margaret and Geoffrey Burbage and William Fowler, published perhaps the most definitive work detailing the precise steps necessary to build up the elements of the universe and predict their known abundances. Their arguments were so precise, powerful, and persuasive that even Gamow had to concede that Hoyle had given the most compelling picture of nucleosynthesis. Gamow, in typical fashion, even coined the following passage, written in biblical style: "In the beginning, when God was creating the elements, in the excitement of counting, he missed calling for mass 5, and so, naturally, no heavier elements could have been formed. God was very much disappointed, and wanted first to contract the universe again, and to start all over from the beginning, but it would be much too simple. Thus, being almighty, God decided to correct his mistake in a most impossible way. And God said, 'Let there be Hoyle,' and there was Hoyle. And God looked at Hoyle, and told him to make heavy elements in any way he pleased, and Hoyle decided to make heavy elements in stars, and to spread them around by supernova explosions." Evidence against the steady state. Over the decades, however, evidence began to slowly mount against the steady-state universe on a number of fronts. Hoyle found himself fighting a losing battle. In his theory, since the universe did not evolve but was continually creating new matter, the early universe should look very much like the present-day universe. Galaxies seen today should look very similar to galaxies billions of years ago. The steady-state theory could then be disproved if there were signs of dramatic evolutionary changes during the course of billions of years. In the 1960s, mysterious sources of immense power were found in outer space, dubbed quasars, or quasi-stellar objects. The name was so catchy that a TV set was later named after it. Quasars generated enormous amounts of power and had huge redshifts, meaning that they were billions of light years away and they also lit up the heavens when the universe was very young. Today, astronomers believe that these are gigantic young galaxies, driven by the power of huge black holes. We do not see any evidence of quasars today, though according to the steady-state theory, they should exist. Over billions of years, they have disappeared. There was another problem with Hoyle's theory. Scientists realized that there was simply too much helium in the universe to fit the predictions of the steady-state universe. Helium, familiar as the gas found in children's balloons and blimps, is actually quite rare on Earth, but it's the second most plentiful element in the universe after hydrogen. It's so rare, in fact, that it was first found in the Sun rather than the Earth. In 1868, scientists analyzed light from the Sun that was sent through a prism. The deflected sunlight broke up into the usual rainbow of colors and spectral lines, but the scientists also detected faint spectral lines caused by a mysterious element never seen before. They mistakenly thought it was a metal, whose names usually end in ium, like lithium and uranium. They named this mysterious metal after the Greek word for sun, helios. Finally, in 1895, helium was found on Earth in uranium deposits, and scientists embarrassingly discovered that it was a gas, not a metal. Thus, helium, first discovered in the sun, was born as a misnomer. If primordial helium was mainly created in the stars, as Hoyle believed, then it should be quite rare and found near the cores of stars. But all the astronomical data showed that helium was actually quite plentiful, making up about 25% of the mass of the atoms in the universe. It was found to be uniformly distributed around the universe, as Gamow believed. Today, we know that both Gamow and Hoyle had pieces of the truth concerning nucleosynthesis. Gamow originally thought that all the chemical elements were fallout, or ashes, of the Big Bang. But his theory fell victim to the five-particle and eight-particle gap. Hoyle thought he could sweep away the Big Bang theory altogether by showing that stars cook all the elements without any need to resort to a Big Bang at all. But his theory failed to account for the huge abundance of helium we now know exists in the universe. In essence, Gamow and Hoyle have given us a complementary picture of nucleosynthesis. The very light elements up to mass 5 and 8 were indeed created by the Big Bang, as Gamow believed. Today, as the result of discoveries in physics, we know that the Big Bang did produce most of the deuterium, helium-3, helium-4, and lithium-7 we see in nature. But the heavier elements, up to iron, were mostly cooked in the cores of stars, as Hoyle believed. If we add the elements beyond iron, such as copper, zinc, and gold, that were blasted out by the blistering heat of a supernova, then we have a complete picture explaining the relative abundances of all the elements in the universe. Any rival theory to modern-day cosmology would have a formidable task to explain the relative abundance of the 100-odd elements in the universe and their myriad isotopes. How stars are born. One byproduct of this intense debate over nucleosynthesis is that it has given us a rather complete description of the life cycle of stars. A typical star, like our Sun, begins its life as a large ball of diffuse hydrogen gas called a protostar and gradually contracts under the force of gravity. As it begins to collapse, it begins to spin rapidly, which often leads to the formation of a double star system, where two stars chase each other in elliptical orbits, or the formation of planets in the plane of rotation of the star. The core of the star also heats up tremendously until it hits approximately 10 million degrees or more, when the fusion of hydrogen to helium takes place. After the star ignites, it is called a main-sequence star, and it may burn for about 10 billion years, slowly turning its core from hydrogen to waste helium. Our sun is currently midway through this process. After the era of hydrogen burning ends, the star begins to burn helium, whereupon it expands enormously to the size of the orbit of Mars and becomes a red giant. After the helium fuel in the core is exhausted, the outer layers of the star dissipate, leaving the core itself, a white dwarf star about the size of Earth. Smaller stars like our sun will die in space as hunks of dead nuclear material in white dwarf stars. But in stars perhaps 10 to 40 times the mass of our sun, the fusion process proceeds much more rapidly. When the star becomes a red supergiant, its core rapidly fuses the lighter elements, so it resembles a hybrid star, a white dwarf inside a red giant. In this white dwarf star, the lighter elements up to iron on the periodic table of elements may be created. When the fusion process reaches the stage where the element iron is created, no more energy can be extracted from the fusion process, so the nuclear furnace, after billions of years, finally shuts down. At this point, the star abruptly collapses, creating huge pressures that actually push the electrons into the nuclei. The density can exceed 400 billion times the density of water. This causes temperatures to soar to trillions of degrees. The gravitational energy compressed into this tiny object explodes outward into a supernova. The intense heat of this process causes fusion to start once again, and the elements beyond iron on the periodic table are synthesized. The red supergiant Betelgeuse, for example, which can be easily seen in the constellation Orion, is unstable. It can explode at any time as a supernova, spewing large quantities of gamma rays and X-rays into the surrounding neighborhood. When that happens, this supernova will be visible in daytime and might outshine the moon at night. It was once thought that the titanic energy released by a supernova destroyed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. A supernova about 10 light-years away could, in fact, end all life on Earth. Fortunately, the giant stars Spica and Betelgeuse are 260 and 430 light-years away, respectively, too far to cause much serious damage to Earth when they finally explode. But some scientists believe that a minor extinction of sea creatures 2 million years ago was caused by a supernova explosion of a star 120 light-years away. This also means that our sun is not Earth's true mother. Although many peoples of Earth have worshipped the sun as a god that gave birth to Earth, this is only partially correct. Although Earth was originally created from the sun, as part of the ecliptic plane of debris and dust that circulated around the sun 4.5 billion years ago, our sun is barely hot enough to fuse hydrogen to helium. This means that our true mother sun was actually an unnamed star or collection of stars that died billions of years ago in a supernova, which then seeded nearby nebulae with the higher elements beyond iron that make up our body. Literally, our bodies are made of stardust from stars that died billions of years ago. In the aftermath of a supernova explosion, there is a tiny remnant called a neutron star, which is made of solid nuclear matter compressed to the size of Manhattan, almost 20 miles in size. Neutron stars were first predicted by Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky in 1933, but they seemed so fantastic that they were ignored by scientists for decades. Because the neutron star is emitting radiation irregularly and is also spinning rapidly, it resembles a spinning lighthouse, spewing radiation as it rotates. As seen from Earth, the neutron star appears to pulsate and is hence called a pulsar. Extremely large stars, perhaps larger than 40 solar masses, when they eventually undergo a supernova explosion, might leave behind a neutron star that is larger than 3 solar masses. The gravity of this neutron star is so large that it can counteract the repulsive force between neutrons, and the star will make its final collapse into perhaps the most exotic object in the universe, a black hole, which I discuss in Chapter 5. Bird Droppings and the Big Bang. The final stake in the heart of the steady-state theory was the discovery of Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson in 1965. Working on the 20-foot Bell Laboratory Holmdel Horn radio telescope in New Jersey, they were looking for radio signals from the heavens when they picked up an unwanted static. They thought it was probably an aberration because it seemed to be coming uniformly from all directions rather than from a single star or galaxy. Thinking the static might have come from dirt and debris, they carefully cleaned off what Penzias described as a white coating of dielectric material, commonly known as bird droppings, that had covered the opening of the radio telescope. The static seemed even larger. Although they did not yet know it, they had accidentally stumbled upon the microwave background predicted by Gamow's group back in 1948. Now the cosmological history reads a little bit like the Keystone Cops, with three groups groping for an answer without any knowledge of the others. On one hand, Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann had laid out the theory behind the microwave background back in 1948. They had predicted the temperature of the microwave radiation to be 5 degrees above absolute zero. They gave up trying to measure the background radiation of space, however, because the instruments back then were not sensitive enough to detect it. In 1965, Penzias and Wilson found this black body radiation but didn't know it. Meanwhile, a third group, led by Robert Dick of Princeton University, had independently rediscovered the theory of Gamow and his colleagues and were actively looking for the background radiation, but their equipment was too woefully primitive to find it. This comical situation ended when a mutual friend, astronomer Bernard Burke, informed Penzias of the work of Robert Dick. When the two groups finally connected, it became clear that Penzias and Wilson had detected signals from the Big Bang itself. For this momentous discovery, Penzias and Wilson won the Nobel Prize in 1978. In hindsight, Hoyle and Gamow, the two most visible proponents of the opposite theories, had a fateful encounter in a Cadillac in 1956 that could have changed the course of cosmology. "I recall George driving me around in a white Cadillac," recalled Hoyle. Gamow repeated his conviction to Hoyle that the Big Bang left an afterglow that should be seen even today. However, Gamow's latest figures placed the temperature of that afterglow at 50 degrees. Then Hoyle made an astounding revelation to Gamow. Hoyle was aware of an obscure paper written in 1941 by Andrew McKellar that showed that the temperature of outer space cannot exceed 3 degrees. At higher temperatures, new reactions can occur which would create excited carbon hydrogen, CH, and carbon nitrogen, CN, radicals in outer space. By measuring the spectra of these chemicals, one could then determine the temperature of outer space. In fact, he found that the density of CN molecules he detected in space indicated a temperature of about 2.3 degrees K. In other words, unknown to Gamow, the 2.7K background radiation had already been indirectly detected in 1941. Hoyle recalled, "Whether it was the too great comfort of the Cadillac, or because George wanted a temperature higher than 3K, whereas I wanted a temperature of 0 degrees, we missed the chance of spotting the discovery made 9 years later by Arno Penzias and Bob Wilson." If Gamow's group had not made a numerical error and had come up with a lower temperature, or if Hoyle had not been so hostile to the Big Bang theory, perhaps history might have been written differently. Personal aftershocks of the Big Bang. The discovery of the microwave background by Penzias and Wilson had a decided effect on the careers of Gamow and Hoyle. To Hoyle, the work of Penzias and Wilson was a near-death experience. Finally, in Nature magazine in 1965, Hoyle officially conceded defeat, citing the microwave background and helium abundance as reasons for abandoning his steady-state theory. But what really disturbed him was that the steady-state theory had lost its predictive power. It is widely believed that the existence of the microwave background killed the steady-state cosmology. But what really killed the steady-state theory was psychology. Here, in the microwave background, was an important phenomenon which it had not predicted. For many years, this knocked the stuffing out of me. Hoyle later reversed himself, trying to tinker with newer variations of the steady-state theory of the universe, but each variation became less and less plausible. Unfortunately, the question of priority left a bad taste in Gamow's mouth. Gamow, if one reads between the lines, was not pleased that his work and the work of Alpha and Hermann were rarely mentioned, if at all. Ever polite, he kept mum about his feelings, but in private letters he wrote that it was unfair that physicists and historians would completely ignore their work. Although the work of Penzias and Wilson was a huge blow to the steady-state theory and helped put the Big Bang on firm experimental footing, there were huge gaps in our understanding of the structure of the expanding universe. In a Friedmann universe, for example, one must know the value of omega, the average distribution of matter in the universe, to understand its evolution. However, the determination of omega became quite problematic when it was realized that most of the universe was not made of familiar atoms and molecules, but a strange new substance called dark matter, which outweighed ordinary matter by a factor of 10. Once again, the leaders in this field were not taken seriously by the rest of the astronomical community. Omega and dark matter. The story of dark matter is perhaps one of the strangest chapters in cosmology. Back in the 1930s, maverick Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky of Caltech noticed that the galaxies in the Coma cluster of galaxies were not moving correctly under Newtonian gravity. These galaxies, he found, moved so fast that they should fly apart and the cluster should dissolve according to Newton's laws of motion. The only way, he thought, that the Coma cluster can be kept together rather than flying apart was if the cluster had hundreds of times more matter than could be seen by telescope. Either Newton's laws were somehow incorrect at galactic distances, or else there was a huge amount of missing invisible matter in the Coma cluster that was holding it together. This was the first indication in history that there was something terribly amiss with regard to the distribution of matter in the universe. Astronomers universally rejected or ignored the pioneering work of Zwicky, unfortunately, for several reasons. First, astronomers were reluctant to believe that Newtonian gravity, which had dominated physics for several centuries, could be incorrect. There was a precedent for handling crises like this in astronomy. When the orbit of Uranus was analyzed in the 19th century, it was found that it wobbled. It deviated by a tiny amount from the equations of Isaac Newton. So either Newton was wrong, or there must be a new planet whose gravity was tugging on Uranus. The latter was correct, and Neptune was found on the first attempt in 1846 by analyzing the location predicted by Newton's laws. Second, there was the question of Zwicky's personality and how astronomers treated outsiders. Zwicky was a visionary who was often ridiculed or ignored in his lifetime. In 1933, with Walter Bodd, he coined the word supernova and correctly predicted that a tiny neutron star, about 14 miles across, would be the ultimate remnant of an exploding star. The idea was so utterly outlandish that it was lampooned in a Los Angeles Times cartoon on January 19, 1934. Zwicky was furious at a small, elite group of astronomers whom he thought tried to exclude him from recognition, stole his ideas, and denied him time on the 100- and 200-inch telescopes. Shortly before he died in 1974, Zwicky self-published a catalogue of the galaxies. The catalogue opened with the heading, "A Reminder to the High Priests of American Astronomy and to Their Sycophants." The essay gave a blistering criticism of the clubby, ingrown nature of the astronomy elite, which tended to shut out mavericks like him. "Today's sycophants and plain thieves seem to be free, in American astronomy in particular, to appropriate discoveries and inventions made by lone wolves and nonconformists," he wrote. He called these individuals spherical bastards because they are bastards any way you look at them. He was incensed that he was passed over when the Nobel Prize was awarded to someone else for the discovery of the neutron star. In 1962, the curious problem with galactic motion was rediscovered by astronomer Vera Rubin. She studied the rotation of the Milky Way galaxy and found the same problem. She, too, received a cold shoulder from the astronomy community. Normally, the farther a planet is from the Sun, the slower it travels. The closer it is, the faster it moves. That's why Mercury is named after the god of speed, because it is so close to the Sun, and why Pluto's velocity is 10 times slower than Mercury's, because it is the farthest from the Sun. However, when Vera Rubin analyzed the blue stars in our galaxy, she found that the stars rotated around the galaxy at the same rate, independent of their distance from the galactic center, which is called a flat rotation curve, thereby violating the precepts of Newtonian mechanics. In fact, she found that the Milky Way galaxy was rotating so fast that, by rights, it should fly apart. But the galaxy has been quite stable for about 10 billion years. It was a mystery why the rotation curve was flat. To keep the galaxy from disintegrating, it had to be 10 times heavier than scientists currently imagined. Apparently, 90% of the mass of the Milky Way galaxy was missing. Vera Rubin was ignored, in part because she was a woman. With a certain amount of pain, she recalls that when she applied to Swarthmore College as a science major and casually told the admissions officer that she liked to paint, the interviewer said, "Have you ever considered a career in which you paint pictures of astronomical objects?" She recalled, "That became a tagline in my family. For many years, whenever anything went wrong for anyone, we said, 'Have you ever considered a career in which you paint pictures of astronomical objects?'" When she told her high school physics teacher that she got accepted to Vassar, he replied, "You should do okay as long as you stay away from science." She would later recall, "It takes an enormous amount of self-esteem to listen to things like that and not be demolished." After she graduated, she applied and was accepted to Harvard. But she declined because she got married and followed her husband, a chemist, to Cornell. She got a letter back from Harvard with the handwritten words written on the bottom, "Damn you women, every time I get a good one ready, she goes off and gets married." Recently, she attended an astronomy conference in Japan, and she was the only woman there. "I really couldn't tell that story for a long time without weeping, because certainly in one generation, not an awful lot has changed," she confessed. Nevertheless, the sheer weight of her careful work and the work of others slowly began to convince the astronomical community of the missing mass problem. By 1978, Rubin and her colleagues had examined 11 spiral galaxies. All of them were spinning too fast to stay together, according to the laws of Newton. That same year, Dutch radio astronomer Albert Bosma published the most complete analysis of dozens of spiral galaxies yet. Almost all of them exhibited the same anomalous behavior. This finally seemed to convince the astronomical community that dark matter did indeed exist. The simplest solution to this distressing problem was to assume that the galaxies were surrounded by an invisible halo that contained 10 times more matter than the stars themselves. Since that time, other, more sophisticated means have been developed to measure the presence of this invisible matter. One of the most impressive is to measure the distortion of starlight as it travels through invisible matter. Like the lens of your glasses, dark matter can bend light because of its enormity.